everyone. Welcome to another episode of Colored Red, the podcast all about Colorado true crime. I'm Laura, and today I'm bringing you a story about, I would say arguably, Colorado's most prolific serial killer. This isn't in terms of crimes that he was actually convicted for. This is in terms of crimes he was later connected to. And I think any investigator in the state would probably say that this guy is Colorado's most prolific serial killer. And chances are, and this is crazy, you guys have probably never heard of him. And I'm going to get into why that might be. But first, let me talk about these victims. There's this term in true crime that I'm sure you all have heard called the less dead. And who are the less dead? This term refers to people whose murders went unnoticed or whose murders were not investigated as quickly as they needed to be because the victims were not people that police force cared about or that families cared about or that the general public cared about. Usually, murder victims who are less dead are people like sex workers and immigrants, homeless people, and sometimes even people who just aren't white. There are stories that are lost forever in ditches and in motel rooms and dumpsters and lives that are lost forever in these places. And there are stories that are only now being talked about and told. And after reading about these cases I'm going to discuss today, I can say with a certain degree of confidence that fortunately, in terms of the police force behind these crimes, this isn't one of those stories. They finally got their man. It just wasn't soon enough. And the crimes have limited information, and multiple people would come forward admitting to the same murders, sometimes with stories of drugs and even a lesbian love triangle. But I would say that ultimately, the coincidences linking this man to these crimes were way too much to ignore. And I'm not a person for coincidences. I'm a person who likes evidence. But in this case, it's just, you can't look past it. I will acknowledge before going any further that it's very possible these crimes are so unknown because the majority of the victims are black and because the killer himself is black. There's this prevailing myth that there are few black serial killers in the United States, and I know that last podcast on the left did a two-part series on this, but this myth is actually false. There's a strong possibility that their crimes haven't been covered in the same depth as white serial killer crimes, because for whatever reasons that this podcast isn't really about, the general public just didn't care about these crimes. And they didn't care about them as much as they do the things like Nancy Grace cares about. So they didn't care about the victims either, unless they were white, and these crimes have been swept under the rug for decades. The following information is taken from an article in PI Magazine, and that's Principal Investigator Magazine, titled Black Serial Killers and Perception Versus Reality. It's a known fact that most FBI profiles for serial murder have described the unknown assailant as a white male, 20 to 40 years old, who resides in the area where the murders occur. The FBI also indicates that most serial murders occur intraracially, and that's within the same race as opposed to interracially, meaning most serial killers kill members of their same race, basically. So when Wayne Williams was arrested for the Atlanta child killings in 1980, the media reported on the event as if there had never been any black serial killer prior to him. So, because the FBI almost always profiled white males as the suspects in serial killings, this resulted in linkage blindness, leading to the embarrassing cases that fell through the cracks in multiple states where they just never suspected that someone other than who they had originally profiled could possibly be committing these murders. And this isn't just for white males versus black males, it's for women committing murders, it's for all kinds of things. So, the statistics behind the reality are thus. Using a list of 476 sexual serial killers in the United States as of 2011, and extracting the crimes within which there was a racial motivation, like a hate crime, a Black Widow situation, a spree killing, or a robbery, the list was reduced to 409 sexual serial killers, who represented 86% of sexual murderers. So of that 409 sexual serial killers remaining, 153 of them were Black, representing 37% of the murders. So prior to 1981, Black serial killers represented 21.8% of the sexual serial killings in the United States. 30% of the cases involved white victims, and 43% of the cases involved Black victims. The most frequent method of killing, and this is the strange part, was by far strangulation, accounting for 67% of the cases. So these stats are what they are, and I'm not trying to say anything here other than that the myth that Blacks are comparatively underrepresented in the serial killer population is just not true. What is true is that these crimes are sadly underreported unless under extraneous circumstances. And for true crime fans, there's this world of cases out there that you probably haven't heard about because there's just not a lot of information out there about them. So this story today is the story of Colorado's potentially most prolific serial killer. And there's a halfway decent chance that you've never even heard of him. He has been dubbed the Colfax Killer, and his name is Vincent Darrell Groves. So the string of events that led to the capture of Vincent Darrell Groves started very early in the morning on Sunday in August of 1988. A man was up before dawn in the Park Hill neighborhood and was packing up his car to drive to a triathlon that he was running in that day. He did this, and as he was doing this, a car pulled up behind his in the alley behind his house. The driver didn't see him standing there. The car was blue, and the headlights were off, which was odd because it was still pretty dark out in the morning. The man noticed that the driver of this blue car was a very tall, slender Black male. He watched the man nervously open the trunk of his car, and to the witness's surprise and shock, he pulled out the body of a woman. As the man ran inside to call police, he heard the door of the car slam and the car drive away, and it made a very distinctive sound as it drove away. The body that he would discover in the alley, and that police would later discover, was the body of Pam Montgomery. And because the witness could never positively identify Groves himself in this case, he would never be charged with that murder. So, but as it would turn out, the police were already pretty familiar with Vincent Groves. While ultimately Groves will only be charged with two murders when he was caught, the similarities of the crimes and the sheer coincidence of his involvement with almost all of the victims will link him to up to 24 victims in the Denver metro area over the span of 10 years or possibly even more, from 1978 to 1988. With a gap in the slayings between 1992 and 1997 when they started up again. This coincides with Groves being in prison for second-degree murder from 1982 to 1987. Vincent Groves was the last person to be seen with at least five of the slain women that I'm going to talk about, and he knew others and lived with more than one of the women, and the DNA connects him to two more cases. A cold case team launched in 2010 would conclusively link Groves to the deaths of Emma Jennifer, 25, found dead in her bathtub in March of 1979. Joyce Ramey, 23, whose body was discovered in an industrial park that July of 1979. Peggy Cuff, 20, who was located in an alley in November of that same year, 1979. And Pam Montgomery, recovered from a different alley in August of 1988 behind the man's house that I just previously mentioned. This team in 2010 was comprised of multiple members, not the least of which was Detective Milos Yearling, who would end up being a major part in the solving of multiple murders linked to Groves. So all of the victims in this case were beaten and strangled, and their bodies were dumped in areas around Denver spanning five counties. His MO was to pick up a woman usually a sex worker, and he sometimes picked up women that he had contact with before, and sometimes these victims were people that he had lived with or acted as a pimp for. And he would just later strangle her and dump her body in an unknown location around Denver. He told police that they would probably find his hair near or on the victims that they later questioned him about because he had slept with them, and he pimped them, and he roomed with them or was friends with them, making him the unluckiest friend of women who ever lived. But before I get into the cases, let's talk a little bit about who Vincent Darrell Groves is. He was born to a middle-class family in Wheat Ridge and was the oldest of three sons. His father was a postal worker and his mother was a teacher. They lived in a brick home on a corner lot that overlooked a neighborhood of ranch-style homes. Groves was a prom king finalist in high school, a member of the student council, and a basketball player on a team that included future NFL wide receiver Dave Logan. He went to college at Coe College in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where he played basketball for 2 years. He would grow to be quite tall and lanky, and he stood out a lot at 6'5", and would be described as having an easy, confident walk. He dropped out of college in 1974 and returned to Colorado to care for his elderly grandmother and work. He didn't consider himself to be religious at all, but he sometimes attended the Baptist church where his father was a deacon and his mother played the organ. And I know that last line honestly sounds like something out of a cliche true crime story, but according to an excellent 5280 article that I'm getting a lot of this out of called Chasing a Ghost by Robert Sanchez, it's actually true. But all wasn't happy church music and taking care of grandma for him. Groves led a life that his family didn't even see. He often drank at a Denver lounge called the New Yorker and was thought to be an alcoholic by some of his friends. At night, he cruised a 5-mile strip of East Colfax, which I'm sure my Denver listeners know about, but to everyone else who's listening in, this is a long stretch of road connecting central downtown Denver to Aurora, and even to this day, it's known for pay-by-the-hour motels and drug sales and that sort of thing. It's much better now. I actually live about 2 blocks from this area of East Colfax, rather. And back then it was much worse than it is now, but there's still plenty of pay-by-the-hour motels and all kinds of stuff down there. So Colfax, if you don't remember, was also one of the streets that Wild Bill Cody, which I have an episode about, also sort of perused while he went to bars. So Colfax is a pretty well-known street in Denver. He made many friends there with pimps and sex workers who he often sold cocaine to. One prostitute was 17-year-old Jeanette Baca, who he did act like a pimp for in some capacity, but the police and none of these reports ever really go into how much pimping he did. So on June 11th, 1978, Jeanette Baca's nude body was found dumped a 1/2 mile from Jefferson County Park. Police interviewed Groves in this case, but charges were never filed against him. So not long afterwards, on March 26, 1979, the body of Emma Jennifer, a 25-year-old, and an employee of Warner Brothers Distribution, was found raped and strangled to death in the bathtub of her rented Cherry Creek apartment. Police found a radio in the bathtub, as if to make it appear that Emma had actually electrocuted herself. They found a blue nightgown neatly spread across her bed, and several glasses of water were in the sink, and the living room television was on. The front door safety chain was dangling. Her boyfriend had been a suspect at the time, but evidence was so scarce that no one could be linked to the crime, and it went unsolved until hitting the desk of Detective Yearling in 2010. They ended up actually clearing her boyfriend, so they were at a complete loss as to who had committed this murder. Less than a year later, Groves moved in with a 21-year-old named Norma Jean Halford, and on August 24, 1979, a Colorado State Trooper discovered Halford's empty car parked along a mountainous road outside of Georgetown, Colorado. She was never located again, and her body was never found. Only 2 months later, the body of Peggy Cuff, A 20-year-old woman who disappeared after her shift at a collections agency was found partially nude on November 3, 1979. She was 5 miles from her work office in an alley 9 blocks from the University of Denver campus. Her body was found face down in a tangle of weeds, and there were blue corduroys on her that were torn from her body. And not until 2010 would the DNA collected from the post-mortem kits in the deaths of Peggy Cuff and Emma Jennifer would it be discovered that they were from the same man, that the same man had committed both murders. But there was no reference genome in CODIS, and they had no idea who to compare this genome to. After these murders had occurred in 1980, Groves then moved into a house in Denver where he continued to sell various drugs. He also worked at the Gates Rubber Factory, a now-demolished factory that used to sit at Broadway and I-25, and it's now the area slated for the new Broadway Station project. All my listeners who grew up in Denver probably remember hearing stories about teenagers breaking into the abandoned factory at one point. I think at one point a girl actually fell through the floor from a high level and broke her back, and they upped the security and the fencing around the Gates factory after that. It was torn down only fairly recently, so maybe most people remember that factory looming over the highway because it was pretty run down and looked pretty crazy for a long time. But that's where Vincent Darrell Groves worked. But anyway, back to Groves. Among the friends he regularly hung out with was a woman named Jeanette Hill. They had met at church years earlier and had recently fallen in love. The two soon began living together in an apartment on Denver's Pearl Street. And Groves quit his job at the rubber factory to do janitorial work around the city. By 1981, Jeanette Hill was starting to come around to this reality that her boyfriend was a drug dealer. He would disappear for days at a time, and he was often drunk. Just before their wedding on March 23, 1981, someone broke a window in their apartment and left a gun on the windowsill as kind of like a threat. And Groves was incredibly scared by this, and he told Jeanette to pack a bag and that they were leaving that night. And so that night they moved in with Groves' parents in Wheat Ridge, and weeks later they were married. And she claims later on that that night, on their wedding night, she went to bed while Groves left to go get high. In the summer of 1981, Groves and his wife Jeanette Hill were fighting a lot. Groves planned to take a break and go on a fishing trip with his two friends and their 17-year-old daughter, Tammy Sue Woodrum. He had a camper attached to the bed of his pickup truck, and he left Jeanette at home and refused to let her come along because they were always fighting. So it was a surprise to her when, the very next day after this camping trip had taken off, Groves appeared back at their house that morning and said that he had something to tell her, but that they would need to go into the mountains for him to tell her what he needed to say. The two drove up into the mountains, and Vincent stopped the car on a winding road and began to sob. He told his wife that he had first picked up the 17-year-old Tammy Woodrum and had driven her to score some cocaine and heroin, possibly. The reports are conflicting on which drug it was. They then drove to Fraser, and the girl began to shoot up. He told his wife through tears that Tammy had overdosed right in front of his eyes and was dead. His wife was dumbfounded, and she asked where the girl was, and Groves told her that Tammy's body was in the camper that they were still pulling. So, at the urging of his wife, Groves turned himself into the Lakewood police. Groves was convicted for second-degree murder in the case of Tammy Sue Woodrum in 1982. His overdose story to the police ended up quickly falling apart. Tammy was found beaten and raped and strangled. Toxicology would prove that Tammy was drug-free when she was strangled, and marks on her body actually matched up to Groves' belt. He was sentenced to just 12 years in prison, which sounds ridiculous, but you're going to shit bricks when you hear this. He would get out after 5 years for a mandatory parole. In 1985, Jeanette Hill divorced Groves, never to see him again. And like I said, on February 13th, 1987, Groves was released on what they called a mandatory parole for whatever reason, I'm not sure. And what would happen is he would end up being released and finding that he had a supportive family who supported his newfound ventures and whatever he was doing. His father even gave him his blue 1978 AMC Concord. And he would work various janitorial jobs around town driving this blue Concord. Groves soon fell back into the East Colfax lifestyle of drugging and sleeping with sex workers in seedy motels. In March of 1987, he picked up 20-something Shelia Washington, and I say 20-something because it's not clear exactly what age she was, and he bought her crack and took her to a motel. Inside room 8 of the El Patio Motel on Colfax, she stripped nearly naked and took a hit from her pipe. She closed her eyes, and then she felt Grove's hands wrapping around her throat. She screamed and fought, kicking over a table, and a man in room 10 heard the fight going on and kicked down their door, go him. There he saw Groves half-naked and standing over Shelia. Groves would race towards his pants and his other clothes and quickly put them on, and he would run out the door and not be caught. So she called the police a week later to report this crime, and she didn't know Groves' name at the time, so there wasn't a whole lot that could be done about it. A year later, she saw him casually driving his very distinguishing blue car down Colfax, and she called the police again. And to their credit, they actually did pull him over, but they only questioned him for a short time and let him go. Around this same time in 1987, a large team led by Lieutenant Tom Haney was looking at Groves in connection with nearly 20 unsolved murders around town. Most of the women were sex workers. Nearly all had been sexually assaulted and strangled. In some cases, Groves was the last person seen with the victim. In others, Groves supplied the drugs to the women or lived with them or was friends with them and knew them. During their investigations, police also learned of attacks on other sex workers, including the one of Shelia Washington, and they were starting to try to put everything together. On September 1st, 1988, police arrested Groves near the corner of South Colorado Boulevard and East Mexico Avenue, on the attempted murder charge of Shelia Washington, the woman who escaped from the El Patio Motel. Police interviewed his parents and his new girlfriend and his ex-wife, among other people associated with Vincent Groves at the time, and his vehicle was taken to an auto repair shop where it was searched and vacuumed. Officers collected hairs that they found in the car. The court documents in this case also indicate that an electrical wire tied into a slip knot was found in the car. So, after being picked up for the attempted murder of Shelia Washington, during this interview with investigators that stretched past midnight, it makes a point of saying, Groves told police that Washington had stolen $1,600 from him, and he never tried to choke her, and he contended that none of this that Shelia was claiming happened ever happened. When an investigator asked about the slew of dead women, Groves admitted that he knew many of them, if not most of them, and that he knew who the killer of the women was. And he looked at a photo of another victim and heard about the evidence that they had collected from his car, and what he literally said to police was, "You've done your homework, and it looks real bad for me." So the investigators tried to piece together information from multiple cases to link to Groves and to try to tie together many different murders before his trial for the attempted murder of Shelia Washington. But the judge rejected this motion because it wasn't what that particular trial was addressing. For the attack on Shelia Washington, there was little actual evidence of the strangulation, you know, despite the marks on her neck that I'm sure were there, and the guy actually seeing all this and hearing it. And at this point, Groves' attorney did what many attorneys did when a victim was a sex worker and who was trying to say that someone had assaulted her. He cited the victim's lifestyle and drug addicted sex worker who was at the time actually serving time for cocaine possession as the reason why the case was weak, and that she was probably lying and that her lifestyle opened her up to be assaulted, and that she was basically being blamed for all of this. And on February 16th, 1989, Groves was acquitted in this case for the assault on Shelley at Washington. But he wasn't exactly out of the woods. In Adams County, investigators were in the midst of linking Groves' DNA pattern to 19-year-old sex worker Juanita Lovato, whose naked body was found in April of 1988 in a field near Strasburg, east of Denver. In Douglas County, they were also looking at Groves, and they were charging him with the murder of a 25-year-old sex worker named Diane Mancera, whose body was dumped a year earlier along I-25, just west of Parker. DNA banding found in the woman's underwear matched the pattern of Groves' DNA structure, and this is what they got him on at that time. For these two murders that they had DNA connecting him to, he was sentenced to life in prison in 1990. But at this time, Groves had hepatitis C and chronic liver problems, and in 1996, his body actually began to completely shut down. With their chances dwindling to get answers, investigators asked him about the murder of a woman named Zabra Mason, a 19-year-old former honor student from Denver who was heading to a job interview when she was found slumped in her vehicle off of West Colfax Avenue. For whatever reason, at the time that Groves was actually questioned about this particular murder, he was in custody and they were just trying to get information out of him. He told police that this bank that he frequented, that he used as his bank, was located right near there. And he gave this indication that he was there for a reason and that he had been there, but he refused to say absolutely anything else about her murder. Groves would end up dying on October 31st, 1996, at 42 years old, from complications due to hepatitis C and liver failure. And so, much later, in 2010, as Yearling and investigators tried to link the DNA found to be the same in those two murder kits, they didn't know who it was, though, they searched more cases and found the following. On an online forum, where they were just looking for people connecting information, and you'd be surprised how much investigators actually look at these things and try to see what ideas people have come up with, they ended up finding a forum talking about the strangulation of a woman named Joyce Ramey, a 23-year-old sex worker from Denver. Her body was discovered on July 4th, 1979, in a field near the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, northwest of downtown. She'd been sexually assaulted and strangled. Although Ramey was white and lived a very high-risk lifestyle, the year and manner of the death were identical to both Cuff and Jennifer murders. Like Cuff, Ramey's body had been dumped kind of just on an outskirt area of Denver. The site where Ramey's body was dumped, an area of East 56th Avenue and Havana Street, was at that point a jumble of loading docks and strips of asphalt and concrete because it had been built up. But at the time that she was found, it was pretty much just fields. They also looked at the case of Norma Jean Halford, who disappeared on August 1979. She and Ramey's names were on a list of women who were murdered or disappeared across the Denver metro area from 1979 to 1988. As at this time, there were a slew of women found murdered across Denver, and police were dumbfounded as to who could be potentially causing this, but it was largely found to be pretty much Vincent Darrell Groves. According to newspaper articles and activities during this time, with the mysterious gap between 1982 and 1987, it was clear that one man was likely responsible, and apparently someone on this forum that this investigator was looking up realized that it was probably Vincent Darrell Groves. And at this point, they realized that they were probably chasing a dead man. Yearling ended up emailing the Colorado Bureau of Investigation for Groves' DNA profile, only to find out that the CBI did not have one on file. Groves died just before DNA screening became mandatory and all such samples were collected by the CBI. So he figured that he could go and find Groves' father and one of his brothers, but they had died, and he only had one remaining brother who could be an option for collecting DNA as a comparison. But they also thought they could exhume Grove's body. But he kind of was going through old cases and realized that they had Grove's DNA collected in a case that he had been convicted for, but it just hadn't been processed. The case that they had his DNA in was the case of Tammy Sue Woodrum. So, Investigator Yearling would get this DNA processed, and he printed off the Tammy Sue Woodrum Groves DNA report, and he compared it to the DNA profiles for Peggy Cuff and Emma Jennifer, and he himself started to get excited when he looked at them, but he also took them to the forensic analyst, who confirmed that they were all a match. Using this newfound information, more cases were brought to light, like the death of Pamela Montgomery, who, if you recall from the beginning of the episode, was witnessed being dumped in an alley by a black man driving a blue car. Unfortunately, there was no DNA in the case, but the witness was taken into an auto repair shop where the car was being stored, and the witness identified it as the car he saw. Additionally, he asked them to turn the engine on so that he could identify it by sound, because he had heard the car making a really strange thunking sound that day. And when they turned it on, he knew that that was the car that had driven up his alley, because it made this incredibly distinctive sound. In addition to Tammy Sue Woodrum, Peggy Cuff, Pam Montgomery, Emma Jennifer, and Juanita Lovato and Diana Mancera, they compiled a list of over 12 more murders that they suspected Groves was involved in, and that was really only the beginning of how many murders they could possibly link him to. So, on Valentine's Day 2012, Detective Yearling and Sergeant Anthony Parisi, who was helping with most of these cases, met with families of the victims that they had contacted after discovering these connections, and they contacted the victims of the families that they had only recently gotten DNA from and discovered that they knew who the killer was all along. Some families had suspected all along that Groves was involved, and they had long known it, but the connection with the DNA had never been made. Others were confused as to how their daughter and Groves had ever come into contact, and it's just anyone's guess how or when or in what scenario these women were walking along the street, leaving their jobs, or, you know, just doing their everyday affairs, and Groves spotted them, and somehow managed to get them in his car, or maybe he attacked them from his car. It's difficult to say what exactly transpired, but he ended up murdering all these women. And how he did this without anybody noticing and where he did it is a complete mystery. He's literally one of the most elusive and basically inconspicuous murderers I've heard of. You know, most people have like an MO that makes them stand out, or they like collecting trophies, or they're doing it in the sadistic way that they enjoy the game of it and the puzzle, and they enjoy messing with cops. And Groves literally was so nonchalant and so quick and so unpredictable with all of his murders that he went completely undetected for most of them until people started putting things together. So here's kind of a list that I've compiled of the names of the victims that I've discussed in the episode, plus some more, starting with, I'm going to go in kind of the timeline progression of his murders. Jeanette Baca, 17, of Denver, found June 11th, 1978 in Jefferson County, and charges are unlikely against him in this case. He's obviously dead now, but there's not really much to link him other than basically just certain details that they have. They interviewed him for hours, actually, and he was caught in a lot of lies after this case, but they could never quite pin anything down on him. Grove's cousin would emerge in this investigation for Jeanette Baca, and while never really saying that Vincent murdered Jeanette, he corroborated information that only the killer could have known, like that Vincent had come home smelling like charcoal, and he had charcoal ash all over himself, and the police knew that at one point the killer had burned Jeanette's clothes in a picnic like a barbecue pit and that they had been burned in charcoal. So it was strange that his cousin would have said something like that. Emma Jennifer, 25, was found on March 26, 1979, and she was found in her bathtub, and she ended up having DNA found, and that was linked to the death of Peggy Cuff. Joyce Ramey, 23, found dumped in a remote area and died in an identical manner to the other victims, but there were was no DNA in this case. Peggy Cuff, November of 1979, disappeared after her shift at the collections agency. Norma Jean Halford, 21, of San Jose, her body was never found, but she was the one whose car was abandoned in Clear Creek County in August of 1979. She had been living with Groves prior to her disappearance. Cynthia Boyd, 19, of Denver. She was found in February of 1980 in Adams County, and no charges were filed in this case, but her manner of her death was identical to all the other victims of Vincent Darrell Groves, and no DNA was found, and this case is actually still open. Tammy Woodrum, 17 years old, strangled to death and found in Vincent Darrell Groves' camper in 1981. He was charged with second-degree murder and her death and paroled after 5 years. Juanita Mitchell, 25, of Waco, Texas. She was found in April of 1981 in an Aurora motel room. No charges are likely in this case, but again, she was found killed in the exact same way as all of his other victims. Pamela Morgan, 17, of Denver, found June 2nd, 1981, in an Aurora motel room. No charges are likely in this case either, and Morgan and Juanita Mitchell's deaths were initially linked by Aurora police due to their proximity and similar manner of death. Zabra Mason, 19 years old, found dead in her car from strangulation in 1987. Vague comments from Groves about her being found near the bank he frequented, but again, this is another case that no charges were filed against Groves in, only because police are attempting to link them later on. Rhonda Fisher, 30, found in April 1987 in Douglas County. Investigations continuing, but no charges are imminent, and this is another one that's still open. He was linked to the rape of an unnamed woman in Adams County back in 1982, and then of the attempted murder of Sheila Washington in 1987. Faye Johnson, 22, of Denver, found in Arapahoe County, January 30th, 1988. Charges are unlikely in this case. Juanita Lovato, 19, of Denver. She was found in Adams County on April 29th, 1988. And Groves was charged with first-degree murder in this case due to the connection with his DNA. Diane Mancera, 25, of Denver, found in Douglas County on July 26, 1988. Groves is charged with first-degree murder due to the connection of his DNA in this case. Carolyn Buchanan, 35, found August 12, 1988 in rural Denver. No charges are expected in this case either. And then Pam Montgomery, August of 1988, was seen dumped in an alley by a witness who remembered Groves' blue car. And as I've stressed before, guys, this is really only a sampling of the cases that they could potentially be linking Groves to. Many other rapes, assaults, and murders have been tentatively linked to Groves, either by eyewitness accounts, largely due to his distinctive characteristics, including his height and his car. It's unclear how many victims Groves may have had, but estimates put it between 14 and 30. Investigators say in this case that there's at least circumstantial evidence linking him to 26 homicides across the Denver metro area. And that's what, like, basically investigators are circumstantially linking him to. And I'm curious if they've ever looked into any Cedar Rapids unsolved strangulation murders during his time, because he did go to college there, and I'm curious at what point he began this murdering spree and exactly what tipped him over into this. Like, we talk all the time about the psychology of serial killers, and just, like, for instance, right now everyone's obsessed with the Ted Bundy case, and for some reason I can't really put my finger on Ted Bundy. I find him really boring. because I think he puts it on a lot, and I think he tries really hard to be the weirdest dude he can be. And so many murderers in so many cases have been swept under the rug or gone unnoticed because the serial killers are not distinguishable. They're not easily found. They do this as a hobby. It's like going to the store and buying a soda at the convenience store. It's just another thing that they do in their day that is normal behavior to them. And those are the serial killers who are completely unnoticed, and they're not talked about, and they could potentially be the most prolific serial killers out there because they don't kill for weird reasons like wanting to mess with the body or anything like that. They kill because they're just sadistic and they want to feel that feeling. And it's unclear what Vincent Darryl Grove's murders were. What his motivation was. He was an opportunistic murderer. He didn't plan. He just saw a chance and he took it. He strangled every victim, he beat them, and he dumped them like trash around the city. There's a lot of things haunting East Colfax, and nothing makes that clearer than the stories I share on this podcast. Some investigators suspected that around the time of Vincent Darryl Grove's that there were multiple serial killers stalking the streets of Denver, and who they were remains to be seen. But many bodies of women were found dumped all along the metro area during this time, and not all have been linked even barely to Groves. So there were other people out there, and who knows who they were. And hopefully one day I can share their stories in order to just say that the killer was found. But Groves went to the grave knowing the details of the murders he committed, and some cases will probably never be solved because DNA was not collected, but I hope that one day they can be. We're definitely finding that out now with all this gene technology that's going on. So, that's my story of Vincent Darryl Groves. I'm sorry there's not more information about it. I find his case completely fascinating. He wasn't a man who had a hard life. He wasn't a man who had a abusive family. He was just doing this as a hobby, essentially. He was doing this for fun. And it's almost more bizarre to me just how nonchalant that he was about these cases and he was about these murders as compared to most other serial killers out there. It was effortless. And I find that very terrifying, personally. But I hope you guys enjoyed the show today. I'm going to try to find... I do have multiple pictures of Vincent Darryl Groves that I'll be posting on Instagram under Colored Red Podcast. But I'm going to do my best to find a bunch of pictures of his victims that I can put up. Like I said, unfortunately, for whatever reason, there's just not that many pictures or stories out there about his victims. But I'm going to try to put together sort of a big picture of all of his victims and get it up on Instagram as well. So, thanks for listening, guys, and until next time.